From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Hong Kong demonstrators dwindle to some degree. Ebola clouds Paris discussions on Africa's economic prospects.
It underscores quite how important investment in health systems is.
HRW calls on Croatia to close psychiatric hospital prisons. And efforts to help unaccompanied immigrant children facing deportation from the U.S. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Pro-democracy protests continue in Hong Kong, although they have subsided as students and civil servants return to school and work after more than a week of demonstrations. Jason Ng is a blogger with the South China Morning Post. He has been observing developments on the streets of Hong Kong and shortly ago spoke with VOA's Doug Bernard.
Right now I am in Admiralty, which is the headquarters of the Occupy Central movement, also known as the Umbrella Revolution, I guess, overseas. We try not to use the word the revolution here because it's very sensitive. It's just going to incur Beijing's wrath, and so we try to stay away from that terminology. And I've been coming down here sort of every day since the movement really started this past Sunday, September 28th.
We've been hearing reports that perhaps the protests may be losing steam. Fewer people are showing up. What can you tell us of what you're seeing, the numbers of people you're seeing, and what they're saying?
Yeah, well, if you come down here in Admiralty today, I mean, you would definitely notice that the crowds are thinning. But then again, the movement has been going on for 7 days. I think that's normal. A lot of the students have been away from home for a week now, and they're getting tired. So I think it's perfectly understandable. And at some points in time, I think just over the course of the past week, the numbers have gone up. It has come down. So it's the situation is changing so rapidly. It's really very difficult to draw the conclusion that the campaign is losing steam. I think all it takes is another incendiary move by the government to bring the crowds back on the street. So it's really hard to say at this point.
We saw also recently news reports going back to this last weekend, some violence in other areas, Mong Kok and other areas of Hong Kong. Are those gathering in the Admiralty, are they talking about concern about their safety?
Everybody's very concerned about their safety. Especially in Mong Kok, especially in Causeway Bay, where the student protesters are severely outnumbered by the thugs that have been sort of mobilized to instigate the crowd. There have been reports of physical assault, reports of sexual assault in the past few days, and there are a lot of YouTube videos, a lot of images on television that are sort of intended to scare people away from Mong Kok and Causeway Bay. So, I mean, this whole thug attack have been quite sort of well orchestrated, I would say.
Finally, Jason, what are protesters saying about the end game? We know that what upset them, at least initially, what would it take for them to either go back to talks, speaking with the government of Hong Kong, or maybe even, you know, kind of drawing to a conclusion the ongoing protests?
Yeah, well, the organizers of the protesters have been very clear from the get-go that the end game is a democracy. It's sort of free election to pick our leader in the year 2017, as it was promised to us by Beijing. Now, that's highly unlikely to happen given how firmly Beijing has dug its heels. So what is going to send people home at this point is for the chief executive to step down, because he's a hugely unpopular politician in Hong Kong. He was seen as the person who was responsible for deploying tear gas on the students this past Sunday, and there's a lot of rumors about how he is, you know, sort of telling the police to work with the thugs in order to get the crowds to go away. So at this point, if he announces his decision to step down, that would definitely lower the temperature quite a bit. People will probably go home, and they will start negotiating with the government as to what the arrangements for the pre-election is for 2017.
Jason Ning, a blogger with the South China Morning Post, speaking with us from Hong Kong. Australia says it carried out its first air mission over Iraq as part of the international coalition fighting Islamic State militants, but did not fire on any targets in two sorties. The Australian flights come days after the country's cabinet approved deploying fighter aircraft and special forces to Iraq. U.S. forces have conducted weeks of airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against Islamic State positions. For the United Nations' perspective on the strategy to deal with the militant group, also known as ISIL, VOA's Carol Castiel, joined by UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, spoke with the UN Deputy Secretary General, Jan Ellison.
The starting point for the United Nations is the fact that this movement, extremist movement, has occupied a part of a sovereign country's territory. And that is a very serious infringement of international law and leads us to, of course, the clear stand that this occupation of territory on their side must be lifted. We hope that there will be a combination of political measures stemming from, hopefully, a more and more inclusive government in Baghdad and possible other measures which seem to be necessary. And we have, for instance, in the case where the Yazidis were stuck in a mountain area, made the statement from the Secretary General that we welcomed an action which opened up the possibility of reaching them through humanitarian means. And therefore, we hope that this coalition will play a role of a positive nature. But I would also add that it is very important that we combine possible military action with also a diplomatic political strategy.
Indeed, and Deputy Secretary General, you have a lot of experience in Iraq, in Iran, certainly in the region. In terms of this political solution, particularly in Iraq, are you optimistic that this can take place soon enough for a change or for a shift in order to combat this Daesh threat, the threat from ISIL?
I cannot be sure. I only want to make the point that it is necessary to pursue the two paths in parallel. I know the dangers coming from this movement. Not only have they taken large parts of the north part of the Iraq, but they are also very close now to Baghdad. So it is a clear danger. The signs from the new government are positive. But unfortunately, there has been a long period of alienation and frustration felt by the Sunni community. And for the attentions of the new government under al-Abadi, for that to reach out to the local communities is probably a longer process. But I hope that they will send those signals clearly so that we can see results very soon in terms of growing support from the Sunni community to realize that the gravest danger for Iraq stems from ISIL or Daesh.
A question from Margaret.
Deputy Secretary General, the day after the United States began the airstrikes in Syria, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made some remarks about them, and he appeared to sort of give his blessing to it. Does the UN believe there's an adequate legal basis for it? He was mentioning that the strikes took place in parts of Syria that were not under the government's control and that there were humanitarian issues. So is that the UN's way of saying that there is an adequate legal basis for it, because Syria did not invite us in to do it like Iraq did?
Well, I must admit that, of course, the international legal case is more difficult to make when it comes to entering another territory, another country's territory. On the other hand, there are very clear Security Council resolutions and decisions taken on dealing with the ISIL threat. And the fact is still that the territory has been taken by this movement from an independent country, and that this independent country is asking for assistance from not least the United States and the coalition. So I would just think that we should hopefully have signals from the Security Council that this action is acceptable. The session that was held under President Obama on foreign fighters was a positive sign that this is seen as a universal threat. And if the Security Council accepts this as an action in line with the principles of the United Nations, we would be very happy to welcome that. There is also a discussion, which is not to me completely clear, whether there is information passed on to the Syrian authorities about the actions taken.
Jan Ellison is the UN Deputy Secretary General. He spoke with Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA, and UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look under the Programs tab for Press Conference USA. The African Union chairwoman is calling for more outside manpower to help break the cycle of the Ebola virus that is ravaging three West African countries. She spoke in Paris during a forum on ways to make Africa's economic growth more sustainable and inclusive. Lisa Bryant has details from the French capital.
In remarks at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, AU Chairwoman Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma welcomed the help of several countries in fighting West Africa's Ebola outbreak, but she said it was not enough.
We are encouraged that we have seen the world pledging, and we've seen on the ground Americans and others building infrastructure, but what we can see is still a gap on the human resource side in these countries.
She said the countries most affected, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, do not have enough health personnel, and some of the health workers have been casualties of the deadly outbreak. African nations and others like Cuba are sending in health workers, but more are needed. This year's Ebola outbreak has killed roughly 3,500 people in West Africa and is expected to batter the economies of the three countries at the epicenter. This has cast a shadow on the OECD conference in Paris. Ministers and development experts gathered here to discuss ways to harness Africa's strong growth, estimated at nearly 5% this year, so it's sustainable and more people can benefit from it. OECD Secretary General Angel Gurria said the Ebola crisis needs an immediate and large-scale response.
But also underscores quite how important investment in health systems is, if we are to avoid seeing history repeat itself. Like climate change, addressing the health systems is a global challenge that needs a global response.
The OECD is calling for more investments in African manufacturing and transportation infrastructure to be able to sell higher value finished products and to boost trade inside Africa and overseas. Right now, Gurria said, Africa accounts for only a tiny percent of the worldwide trade in these so-called value-added commodities.
We speak of Factory Asia, but I look forward to the day when we can also speak of Factory Africa.
Gurria called for greater institutional reforms and investment in new technology, particularly in renewable energy. He said this year the number of renewable green energy projects commissioned in sub-Saharan Africa may surpass the total of the past 14 years. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
There is one known person believed to have developed Ebola while in the United States. A Liberian-born man now in the state of Texas is said to be fighting for his life at a Dallas hospital. Dr. Thomas Frieden, chief of the Centers for Disease Control, spoke with NBC's Matt Lauer about patient Thomas Duncan.
Our hopes and prayers are with him, and we recognize that this is a critical time for him and for his family. This is the time when we're particularly looking at the contacts that he had. 10 contacts who definitely had contact with him, and 38 others who might have had contact. Every single one of those 48 people was monitored yesterday. The temperatures were taken. None of them had symptoms. None of them had fever. The key here is to keep doing that every single day, as Texas is doing excellently. Have fever, isolate them to stop the transmission.
When you say isolate them, I just want to make sure we're clear on this. Are they being called every day and being told, are you taking your temperature? Or is there someone watching these people to make sure they don't inadvertently slip out of their homes and expose other people?
Their temperatures are being taken directly by outreach staff from health departments in Texas. In addition, their locations are known, and if any of them might slip out, as you put it, that's being addressed appropriately by authorities in Texas.
As you know, there's an American photojournalist, Ashoka Mukpa, or Mukpa, excuse me, who's arriving in Nebraska today for treatment. How closely will the CDC work with that health center there?
Very closely. We've worked with them already. We consult with their clinicians about the care of the patient. We've already been doing that on the way over. And we'll also make sure that the doctors and nurses and whole team taking care of him does that in a way that doesn't put them at risk by providing them with support.
And just quickly now, if we can, officials in this country have had a chance to get their hands on and observe closely several people infected with this Ebola virus right now. Has that work led us any closer to a vaccine? And something else we haven't heard about in several weeks, Dr. Frieden, ZMapp, that experimental serum that was given to at least two of the patients. Is there any more on that? Is it any more promising in your opinion?
We don't know if ZMapp works, but there's no more of it now. The company is working hard to make a few more doses, but it's hard to make. It takes a long time. We have learned how very important fluid and electrolyte management is. Rehydration of patients can be life-saving, and that's something that we're taking back to Africa to try to improve the care there, to improve the rehydration of patients, because that'll make a difference. And, you know, we are seeing signs of progress. CDC has now trained more than 4,000 health workers in Africa. We're training health workers in this country. We're seeing people from all over the world come to help out in Africa. We've seen the exit screening identify 77 right. people and get them off the planes in Africa. So I think we are definitely seeing signs of progress.
Dr. Thomas Frieden, chief of the Centers for Disease Control, speaking with NBC's Matt Lauer on the Today program. Thousands of people with intellectual or psychosocial disabilities are living in segregated institutions and psychiatric hospitals in Croatia, with little control over decisions that affect their lives, according to Human Rights Watch in a report published today. Asela Hennessy reports from London. The World Health Organization says governments around the world, including in Africa and Asia, are failing those who live with mental health disorders.
Ladislav Lamza is director of the Home for Mentally Ill Adults in Osijek, a social welfare home for adults with psychosocial disabilities in Croatia. He says life inside the institution is similar to living in a prison.
One ovdje ne mogu imati svoj život I ne mogu zahtijevati neku svoju.
He says patients cannot have their own lives. They cannot demand any privacy. They do not have any choices. You can't even choose the person with whom you will share a room. Human Rights Watch says despite the grim conditions in some mental hospitals, the Croatian government is making progress in protecting the rights of people with psychosocial disabilities. 11 of 46 state institutions have started the process of deinstitutionalization, and more than 500 people have been moved into the community. But HRW says the process needs to move faster and reach more people. It says more than 8,000 people are still living in what the rights group deems institutions. In Osijek, those who are moved into the community are offered support and given assistance if it's needed. Lamza says many learn very quickly how to cope alone.
Ne dajemo pomoć, nego dajemo, pružamo podršku. Tu smo ako treba.
They make progress by themselves, he says, and recover so quickly that in a matter of months, some are fully independent, shopping, paying bills, fulfilling their needs in the community. For this report, Human Rights Watch interviewed over 80 people in three regions in Croatia. Shanta Rao Berega is director of disability rights at Human Rights Watch.
It's a better investment of money to move people into the community because over time they're going to be able to live on their own without all of the support services that are paid for in institutions.
Shekar Saxena is director of the Mental Health and Substance Abuse Department at the World Health Organization. He says science has developed enough for health experts to be able to do much more for people who are staying at home within their communities. Mental hospitals cost little money, he says, but they do not provide the treatment needed. And yet across Europe, he says, there are still far too many institutions in operation.
Many European countries have economically developed and their health systems have become much better, but their mental health systems are still lagging behind. And mental hospitals, large ones, are really a very bad example of how economic development does not necessarily lead to improved welfare of people with mental disorders.
Many other regions of the world have an equally difficult situation, he says. In Africa, he says, there are very few psychiatrists and mental health professionals. Countries need to train their general doctors and nurses to look after people with mental disorders, especially in communities and not in mental hospitals, he says. In Asia, very large mental health hospitals are widespread, he says. He says many countries spend less than 1% of their health budget on mental health, despite the widespread prevalence of mental disorders.
It's larger than the prevalence of diabetes and cancers put together, even for severe mental disorders. Mild mental disorders are very much more common.
In 2013, 194 World Health Organization member states adopted the Mental Health Action Plan, which sets a number of key targets to be reached by 2020. One of the basic pillars of the plan is to provide care in communities, not in institutions. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
New York is a popular destination for immigrants seeking protection from violence, political oppression, or poverty back home. But over the past decade, as gangland violence has escalated in Central America, U.S. immigration courts have become overwhelmed by the number of immigrants seeking refuge. Tens of thousands are unaccompanied children who often lack lawyers or advocates during their deportation hearings. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a free state-sponsored training workshop for those who want to help.
Several dozen people were attending an intensive two-day training at New York Law School recently. It will help qualify them to represent immigrants at New York's federal immigration courts, which are among the nation's busiest. Attorney Camille Mackler of the New York Immigration Coalition was the workshop instructor. She explained why the training is necessary for lawyers and lay advocates alike.
Right now, there's about 50,000 cases pending in front of the New York City Immigration Court. The average length of a case is 4 years from start to finish, just because the judges are so busy and immigration courts are so underfunded that they just aren't the resources to meet the number of people on there.
Mackler acknowledges that immigrants, especially child immigrants, might welcome the chance to stay in New York for 4 years while waiting for their hearing.
Well, yes, but you need to know that you have a case that you can apply for. Because if you just go in front of the judge and you don't realize that you're entitled, and these children, 80% of them are entitled to some form of relief under the laws that exist today, but they don't know that. I mean, it takes somebody trained in this area to know and to be able to get that case going for those 4 years.
Nigerian-born Ulubumi Segun, who received her law degree in England, hopes the workshops will help her gain competence and reduce stress for her and her clients.
There's so many people who've been here for years. Home is here now. And it's difficult for them to imagine being shipped off back to a country, even though they were born there, but they haven't lived there for years. They've had kids here, they've become acclimatized. And when you step into immigration court and you know that they trust you, and I feel a lot of pressure, as in I have to deliver. And that's why I'm here, to understand the little bits and tricks, or how best you can diligently assist them and ensure that they get to remain here.
Fellow trainee Abir Alharazi is a lay immigrant caseworker for the Arab American Association of New York, a grassroots nonprofit organization. Abir says she wants to help others avoid the demoralizing uncertainty she underwent for 10 years, beginning in 2001 when she emigrated from Yemen.
You cannot work, you cannot go to jobs, you can't establish your life, you know, and that could lead you to go to the dark sides of your life.
There are many other reasons why lawyers and laypersons take immigration advocacy training. Some see it as a social justice issue. They say everyone should be given adequate representation in court. If an immigrant cannot afford an advocate themselves, the state should provide one. One woman who works for a social services agency wants to help her HIV-positive clients get their deportation orders deferred if they're unable to obtain or afford AIDS medication back home. Either way, the training will continue, if only because the tide of immigrants seeking to live in the U.S. will almost certainly continue to rise, and with it, the strain both on the courts and on individuals hoping to start a new life in America. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. You can also re-listen to this program if you like by going to the Programs tab and scrolling on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.